Matthew Moyer. He's a former state's attorney, and he was also a prosecutor with the U.S. Attorney's Office. And now he works for the country's best personal injury firm, Clifford Law Offices. And he is the author of a new book, American Justice from the Front Lines of the War on Crime. Welcome, Matthew.
Thank you very much, and it's great to be here.
And as a good lawyer, you're all dressed in your suit. Maybe you're coming from church. I don't know. But you look the part, and you look like a lawyer just stepping out of the courthouse.
Yes, that's how I like to look.
So your book is really well done. You're a young lawyer, and this book is great because it talks about different cases that you handled, that you were involved in. It kind of gives you the behind-the-scenes look at how cases are put together by prosecutors and how sometimes the system works and sometimes it doesn't. But it doesn't leave you with a feeling that one way is better than the other. You kind of leave people to come up with their own idea about whether the system is actually working. But I want to start with the basics. And again, if anyone has any questions for someone who is a prosecutor, 312-981-7200. Talk to us about the difference between the state's attorney's office and the U.S. attorney's office.
Sure. So from the most fundamental perspective, the state's attorney's office is acting under state law, right? Your state lawmakers, in our case in Springfield, Illinois, they pass laws. They criminalize certain conduct, you know, robbery, carjacking, murder. Now, the federal authorities criminalize basically the same things. But the state prosecutor is the lawyer that is responsible for looking at evidence that, you know, like, for example, the Chicago Police Department puts together. They bring it to the state prosecutor. Here we call it a state's attorney. In other places, they call it a district attorney. And they say, Mr. Prosecutor or Mrs. Prosecutor, do we have enough? And that prosecutor makes a decision on whether the case should be charged in court. Once you get to court, the prosecutor's office sends their prosecutors in to marshal the case from beginning to end. They hand the evidence to the defense. If the criminal defendant doesn't plead guilty, the prosecutor's got to go to trial against them. The state prosecutor is handling a high volume. Every run-of-the-mill case is going to go through, you know, a department like Chicago Police Department or, you know, Tinley Park or Arlington Heights Police Department. And the prosecutor's going to work to develop the evidence with the police department and ultimately prove the case in court against the defendant and their lawyer. The difference between the state prosecutor or the district attorney and the federal prosecutors is the federal prosecutors are very selective in what cases they take. The federal prosecutors work with the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, federal agencies. And what they do is they partner with local law enforcement to make very big cases using, you know, the federal resources and a high level of expertise. So they're going after major criminal organizations or major fraudsters, financial crimes, things of that nature.
And you see the federal prosecutors, they win. You know, I don't know what the statistic is for the percentages they win, but going up against the feds, you hardly ever see a not guilty. You see a lot of plea bargains. For reasons that, you know, probably they were afraid to go to trial. Why is it that the cases are so inclined to be guilty in federal court?
So because the federal authorities, the FBI working with the U.S. attorney's offices under the umbrella of the DOJ, because they get to pick what cases they bring, and the point is to make an impact and send reverberations through the criminal underworld that the feds are going to get you, because it's kind of a choice as to what offenses they go after, they tend to pick ones that they can actually prove, because the point is to deter crime and to make big cases and to make them powerfully with strong evidence. So they tend to steer clear of cases that are likely to be losing cases and let the local prosecutors scrap their way into a victory on those ones, which they do. But that's reason number one. Reason number two is you have some top talent at the federal prosecutor's offices, if I do say so myself.
They pick the top law schools, people with really good experience, good grades, good everything.
So you have really, really intelligent, hardworking prosecutors that work with very, very capable federal agents to make the cases You know, they pick cases that they can prove, and then they make them even stronger so that they just hit it out of the park.
I love the fact that you say that, that feds pick cases so they can deter, but the question that I'm going to leave hanging when we go to break here is then why do we have so much political corruption? Because it's like time after time we see politicians, local, federal, state, get convicted, go to jail for doing things and doing dishonest things, and yet as soon as one's done, we have another one coming down the pike.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think that kind of criminal, the corrupt politician, I think most of them think that they're too clever to ever really be caught. So it's hard to deter the person that thinks that they're above the law and that thinks that no one's ever going to catch them. And maybe there are people out there that we haven't caught yet that are involved in government. Maybe they're right. But, you know, I think that it's hard to deter that type.
And the other question, again, without an answer, is do people who are so inclined run for office, or do you take office and then you become that person? So that's a question that I think I don't know that we can answer here on WGN. We've got a lot of things to cover here, but one of the things I wanted to ask you, Matt, is warrants. And we all know what a warrant is. But can you walk us through the process of obtaining a warrant? I think a lot of people think it's like a rubber stamp. You just, you know, give a warrant to a judge. The judge looks at it and rubber stamps it, and there you go.
Yeah, so basically law enforcement needs a warrant anytime they want to go searching for evidence of a crime. In a private place. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution guarantees everyone a right to privacy. The Supreme Court has held that that includes spaces like the digital space in your phone. Law enforcement agents can't just search someone's phone. They need a warrant. They also can't even search your social media accounts. So if Facebook has a digital copy of your whole account, they can't just give it to law enforcement. There needs to be a warrant. So say I have a case as a prosecutor where I'm working with an FBI agent and they catch someone who's possessing fentanyl, and they say, listen, if you cooperate with us, you know, you'll have lesser charges or something like that. So that person says, fine, I'll show you where I got the fentanyl. Here's a guy. All I know is his Snapchat username, right? And then maybe they go do some buys with this this person who's been caught and wants to have favorable treatment. So that person then goes and the FBI gets some pictures of him, and they have his Snapchat username. Law enforcement officers draft up a search warrant that's kind of edited and curated by the prosecutor, who helps them kind of make it so that it meets the legal standard, which is probable cause that a crime's been committed by a person. And they're going to say, there's this Snapchat username, and this is the person whose Snapchat account we want to search. We want Snapchat to give us a digital copy of everything in that account so we can find out about their fentanyl dealing. And so they talk about all the deals. They even might paste some pictures of the dealer that they got during the deal with the person who's been flipped to be an informant. And a judge, in my case, as a federal prosecutor, a federal judge, they're going to look very closely and say, we want to make sure this person's actually guilty to the level of probable cause in the way that you say he is. So we're not just searching innocent people's private affairs. And so you get that. Whether it's Facebook, Snapchat, Instagram, they give you a digital copy of an account, and it shows you all the people they're messaging and all the drug deals they're setting up, and it serves as great evidence.
So word to the wise out there. Don't do your fentanyl deals on social media.
Indeed.
Yeah, indeed. So I'm going to flip back to some of the stories that you told in your experience as a state's attorney, flipping back to the state's office here. You talk a lot about some of these juvenile offenders. And you know, if you can explain to our listeners the idea of juvenile court, where you're prosecuting juveniles versus abuse and neglect, and how sometimes there's a crossover.
Sure. So juveniles are prosecuted in a whole different system, a whole different courthouse, in the case of Cook County, than adult offenders. Juveniles who are prosecuted, the goal is not, you know, for adults, I'll say, the goal of punishing them to a prison sentence is in part to rehabilitate them, but in large part to protect the community, to deter other people from committing crimes. For juveniles, really, they make the entire focus rehabilitating the juvenile. In other words, making it so that they don't want to commit more crimes in the future, and so they can be a productive member of society. So in Cook County, Illinois, where Chicago is, one half of the building of the juvenile center is dealing with juvenile crimes, where they're charged and given some kind of a sentence. But ultimately, the goal is to be a little bit gentle with them so that you don't turn them into a hardened offender sitting in, you know, prison for years. You know, and that's how the juvenile crime system works. And then the other half of the building is the child protection unit, where you're actually going after parents and possibly terminating their parental rights when they so seriously and severely abuse their children. So those are kind of the two wings of the juvenile unit in Cook County, Illinois, and other places throughout the state.
And I have heard, and I imagine it's true, that when you see abused and neglected children, oftentimes, tragically, they then cross over into the offender part because of their bad backgrounds. You know, you have a story about a kid who stole a car, and he was 11 years old, and he was waving a pistol around, and you know, it's sort of, and you say in your book, he didn't look older than he really was. He was a kid, you know, like who, you know, could have used a car seat almost, you know. Is there a point in time where you think someone is so far gone? And do you see that? And do you have that sort of cynical view now that you've been kind of embedded in that process?
Yeah, you know, I do have a pretty cynical view, unfortunately, because you see some of these, well, in that kid's case, a pre-teenager, but often the teenagers who are 16 and 17, I mean, they're putting to shame some of the most hardened, seasoned adult offenders who are in their 20s and in their 30s. And honestly, it's tough to look at them and think, well, you know, this is just a kid that can be rehabilitated, because you release them, as the judges do, because they think, hey, we got to rehabilitate him. We can't hold him in custody. Let's give him a second, a third, a fourth chance. And they just keep doing it. And they literally laugh at the judges. I mean, we've done search warrants on their phones and their accounts, and they're like, oh, Judge so-and-so is just going to let me out again. Ha ha ha. You know, emoji smiley face. And, it really makes me think, man, these guys they're young. You can't treat them quite like an adult because the law tells us not to. And I respect that. And I believe that. But at a certain point, you gotta be a little more serious than we are now, because they're literally laughing at us as we treat them so tenderly.
And I would imagine that sometimes in the gangs and in some of the areas that the older offenders will give the younger offenders responsibility, knowing that they're going to be out and knowing that they're going to be treated a little bit less harshly than the older ones.
You can't even imagine how true that is. So a lot of times when there are organized crimes being undertaken, drug dealing, they'll put the drugs in the hands of the juveniles. The younger, the better. I mean, if they can get a 9-year-old to do it, they will, because they know a 9-year-old won't even be charged. Their parents will be called, you know, and the kid will just be right back out helping the gang until they're older and more seasoned. But even where it's like the pre-teenagers and teenagers, they'll be handled very lightly. And often if there's a gang beef where there's a shooting that needs to be done of the rivals because of some ongoing dispute, they will make sure that it's the ones who are under 18 that do it, because even a murder, they may only be in custody for a couple years at most.
We have literally a minute, but I want to get this question in and a quick answer. Carjackings. What is up with carjackings? Why are these kids doing it? They don't seem to be really profiting a lot monetarily. What is the purpose of the carjack?
So it's about the most shocking possible answer, which is the purpose of the carjacking is the carjacking itself. It's the terror they strike in the person. They often target vulnerable people and beat them even if they're defenseless. They're not doing it to joyride. They're not chopping the cars and selling them on the black market. They're just doing it to terrify the person and, you know, have a quick little ride around town and ditch the car.
That seems to me to be more terrifying than if there was a purpose.
I agree.
Right? Like, I mean, at least you can understand I'm going to bring home some money to do something, but that just seems inhuman. All right, Matt, I want to talk just briefly about something that's very interesting about how the gang world in Chicago has changed and how it changes the way these cases are being prosecuted.
Yeah, so in the 90s and early 2000s, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, as well as Chicago Police and the State's Attorney's Office, they had a full-blown effort to just rip up the gangs by the roots. You know, there were highly, highly organized gangs where they had, like, the gang leader living out in a suburb in a multi-million dollar house, and there would be the ranks all the way down to street level, like teenagers who would deal the drugs. There was a lot of disputes about the you know, territories that each gang was able to defend in order to sell its drugs in. And it was kind of like a big profit machine of selling drugs. And that was kind of that's kind of what the disputes all centered around is turf. And, the leaders of these gangs were profiting from massive scale drug operations. But because the organizations were so organized, law enforcement was able to kind of rip them up by the roots and, you do these big RICO, that's Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act prosecutions, where they charged these street gangs basically under the law that was passed to defeat the mafia. And they charged them as organizations committing racketeering acts, and they're able to throw in all the members that they can possibly throw in to the charges. And so with all these people swept up off the streets, you saw, you know, overnight the vice lords, the four corner hustlers, the gangster disciples, gangs like this were just totally taken aback by this. They were totally caught off guard. And what was left in the place of these highly organized, structured gangs were these tiny cells of, you know, 10 to 20 small gangs called cliques. And in this day and age, the cliques are run by very young men. The drug dealing is very disorganized. It's not very centered around like the leader reaping all the profit. It's kind of freelance. And the majority of the beefs, the majority of the battles stem not from turf wars for drug territory, but rather from interpersonal disputes that start on Facebook or that start from some YouTube rap video where one gang calls out the other gang. And it's basically just total chaos, and it makes it a lot harder to prosecute these gangs and to knock them out in one big fell swoop through a giant, all-encompassing indictment.
Yeah, and when you read about these crimes, what you're reading is the most ridiculous stuff in the world. It's like he came in and shot up this entire nightclub because the one guy said something bad about his girlfriend in a rap, you know, in a rap song, you know, and you sit there and you go, really? But that, you know, that's the nature of what you're seeing now. And to me, that would be harder to prosecute.
It's much harder because, you know, you catch one and you put him in prison, and then there's another dispute tomorrow. I mean, and it just never ends. I mean, sometimes the members of these gangs actually feel this righteous indignation because maybe their gang member shot someone 5 years ago, but now the revenge came back to them, and then maybe innocent people were swept up in it. So they feel vindicated, like, well, you killed innocent people. You killed somebody's sister. You killed someone's grandma. So then they fire back and kill the innocents on the other side. And it's just a never-ending cycle of continued violence.
And that's why you see some of these community, I don't know what you actually call them, the guys who come out and talk to these kids in the community to try to stop some of this petty dispute that is going on. There's a case that came up in the news this week. A Tennessee grandmother spent more than 5 months in jail after police used facial recognition to link her to crimes in North Dakota, a state that she has never been in. She finally got out. I don't know what took so long, but you know, and I'm assuming we're going to see a lawsuit arise out of that. But tell us, how is facial recognition used by police and prosecutors?
Yeah, so, you know, when I was a prosecutor, I wasn't privy directly to any sort of, you know, use of facial recognition in order to nab people. But I got a sense that it was coming. You hear some things through the grapevine in the law enforcement community. And basically, I believe that today it's probably not being fully disclosed every time it's being used, but I think there's just law enforcement has a database full of everyone's driver's license picture and maybe even fed by social media pictures. And there are likely third party, you know, private contractors who house all this data and can conduct like an analysis, an AI driven even analysis on, you know, when you have a picture of someone's face at a crime scene, they can relate it to those publicly available photos that the government has. And I think that these third party companies in the government are likely already working together to try to nab people using facial recognition. And I think it's a pretty slippery slope, if I'm being honest.
Yeah. And I just saw that Illinois lawmakers are introducing legislation to bar prosecutions based on facial recognition. I don't know if that means that they have to do more than just recognize the person. They have to actually go out and get some evidence against that person besides facial recognition, or if that means it can't be used at all. But I think it's something that we really need to keep our eye on because at least as to women and as to people of color, there is a higher percentage of misidentification when it comes to the use of these things, at least as the technology stands now. Matt, you're here. We're talking about your book, which is a really fun book to read. A lot of my listeners are legal files, and I would highly recommend this book, American Justice from the Frontlines of the War on Crime. Let's see, what we were talking about some of these horrific cases about the CAP team. Tell me, and let's go back. We're talking about abused and neglected children, and there's a team. Unfortunately, there has to be a team in Chicago that investigates these horrible things. Tell us what this team is and what they do.
Yeah, so there's a few different dimensions to child abuse prosecution. I worked in the unit that dealt with temporarily or sometimes permanently terminating parental rights, where parents were found to have abused their kids or neglected them. Usually DCFS gets involved, they see what's going on, and they remove the kids from the house. There's also a team of criminal prosecutors who prosecute people for abusing their kids, sometimes neglect, but most commonly really severe physical abuse. And so the criminal prosecutors also go after parents and others who abuse children physically or sexually or otherwise.
And is it, I mean, when you see these cases in the newspaper, I mean, they break your heart. And there was just one a couple weeks ago where they starved their child, and beat them. And, do you have any close-up view of what causes parents to do this and how this kind of stuff slips between the cracks, that people don't see it and people don't report it? Do you think our DCFS is maybe not doing a great job?
DCFS is so overburdened with cases. There's way more than they could ever be expected to manage. I saw DCFS investigators that did a great, really, really phenomenal job protecting kids, and they put their heart and soul into protecting your children. But there are, some that are not as good as others at noticing the signs of abuse, and they let a case slip through the cracks, and then a kid gets abused again, and the unthinkable happens. So,
or they get burned out.
Yeah,
there's a lot of burnout there.
DCFS, particularly the investigators who have to go on scene and physically remove the kids with police officers, that has an incredibly high turnover. I mean, I would see the DCFS investigators pop up in some other role within DCFS. What happened? And they'd say, I just couldn't keep doing it.
Yeah. I mean, I guess when you're in any area of law or any area of anything, when you're facing the bad things in this world, it just, you have to really put your mind in a better place to say that this is not the way normal people act. But as a prosecutor, you see all these terrible things. You see kids who are 11 waving guns. You see people stealing money. You see carjackers. You see bank robbers. You see people who are on drugs stealing from their grandmothers. I mean, you see the bad things in life. And how do you separate yourself from that and not become jaded?
It's really difficult. It makes you appreciate your own life. It makes you appreciate the things that are good and happy and stable in your own life. It does make you a little wary, about what goes on out there. I mean, I know I may struggle when my kids get older with letting them ride their bike around the neighborhood because I'll be afraid that, John Wayne Gacy's out there or something.
Right. Well, and as we know with Professor Ramsland interview, we wouldn't even know that he was a danger to anybody. Let's talk a little bit about some of the paper crimes. You talk about this in your book. It looks like during COVID there was like lots of this stuff going on. We're still hearing about investigations unraveling people who stole millions of dollars, people even in government stealing money from these programs. Is this something that you think, and I'm not going to justify the behavior, I'm just saying, was it just too much to put all this money in front of people with such a short period of time to access it and apply for it without the oversight? Are some people just going to be tempted to violate the law in a situation like that?
Yes, that's exactly right. So under the during COVID, they made loans available for small businesses under the Small Business Administration. And basically, they had no guardrails. I had a trial where we prosecuted a guy for creating fake businesses, making them look like they were backdated to, basically having been created many, many years before COVID. So that entitled them to certain loans, which were then forgiven. And he got millions this way. And we asked our Small Business Administration witness who had to testify about what had happened, what were the guardrails? Like, how did this guy get so many millions? And he said, look, it was a crisis. We just couldn't figure out who was being fraudulent and who was legitimate. It was just too much to investigate. So a lot of money just went flying out the door. And it applied with the COVID loan programs. It also applies with some of the other benefits benefit programs where these guys divert funds from food stamps and WIC benefits to themselves. And it hurts the integrity of the programs. It takes money away from those who need it most. And, you know, the last thing I can say is I talked to an IRS agent who they investigate this stuff. And I said, what percentage of, say, COVID money went to fraudsters? And said at least 50%, probably more like 75%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. That's just that's unfortunate. And I don't know if you can weigh in on this, and maybe you didn't really see it when you were prosecuting, but I have a theory that with all of this gambling that is now proliferating, especially sports gambling, I see a lot of young people who are online in college, you know, betting on sports, the enticement that these companies give young people to get them and reel them in, give them free chits to get their feet wet. And now you can bet on pretty much anything in the world. So do you see this moving into criminal area? Do you see it, making crime proliferate?
Definitely. I think that especially with the prop bets where, you know, one of these sites, Kalshi or whatever, will say, you know, they'll put a bet down where it says, if this political figure says this word in their speech, you know, then this is the payout or whatever. You're going to have that person telling someone who's going to tell someone who's going to tell someone. There's going to be a lot of attenuation, but it'll be conveyed that they will, in fact, say the word or that they won't. And then the friend of the friend of the friend will know how to bet accordingly, and they'll pay money back up the chain of command there. And I'm sure that's already happening. You know, people have been doing this a while, but the proliferation of these betting websites, it's definitely going to make the rigging of these bets become a lot worse.
Yeah, and what I have seen too is, and I don't know the psychological reality of it, but in my family law experience, I see domestic violence related to gambling, and here's how it works. Let's say it's the man who's going out and he's just gambled away $30,000. Wife looks online and says, honey, what did you do with $30,000? Oh, I just lost it in sports betting. Oh, can you just not do that? Boom, slap.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not saying it happens all the time, but I see it. And I, when people are addicted to something, whether that's drugs or alcohol or anything else, even though they're not impaired in a way that you understand, like drugs, you know, you're out of your mind. But I think when you want that addiction and you want access to the funds to feed your addiction and someone's standing in your way, I think that can result in violence.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that gamblers are chasing a high. Many of them have won big at some point.
Yes.
It's not like they're always losing that keeps them coming back. And so they win big. They're chasing a high, just like drug addicts or people who are addicted to alcohol. And just like with those people, if someone tries to step in the way, it can cause some issues.
Absolutely. And just one last question, and this is kind of a big question, but, you know, crime has gone down in Chicago as it has gone down in almost all areas of our country, but there's still a perception that Chicago's dangerous. I mean, all you have to do is read the paper, and there's something that just happened in broad daylight. I think a woman was sexually assaulted on Michigan Avenue this past week. If you could do something or change something about our society, about our Chicago, it would, you know, about incarceration, about prosecution, about police, what would it be, and what do you think would be most effective to ease crime here in Chicago?
Yeah, so I'm kind of a little bit, this shouldn't be a radical position, but I think you take your resources, you're going after victimless crimes, you take all those resources or a large portion of them, and you put them into investigating and prosecuting crimes with victims, violent criminal offenses, sex offenses, the property crimes where they stick a gun in your face and take your car, that kind of thing. I think we should focus extremely heavily, almost singularly, on violent criminal offenses, especially when they're against a random person. That really shakes the public's trust in its city and its society. When you could just be on Michigan Avenue and you can get assaulted or you get carjacked in broad daylight. I mean, I think we should be pretty harsh, maybe more harsh than we're being on people who target others randomly for violence, and perhaps even if that means taking away funding for, you know, going after victimless crimes.
That makes sense, and maybe you will wave your magic wand and that will happen. Thank you so much for joining me here on Easter Sunday, Matthew Moyer. He's a former state's attorney and U.S. attorney who wrote a really good book, American Justice from the Front Lines of the War on Crime. He now works at Clifford Law Offices, a fabulous personal injury firm. They do catastrophic losses, aviation disasters. I know that your firm has been involved in like every plane crash in the last four decades. And give Bob Clifford my very best, and thanks again for coming in.
Will do. Thank you.